Welcome to Water Insider, a podcast brought to you by DHI. Whether you work with urban or inland water systems, marine or offshore, we get experts to discuss everything water, so you can be the first to learn the latest in water tech and trends.
Welcome, everybody, to this podcast episode, Let's Talk EIAs and Regulations in Offshore Wind. My name is Frank Thompson, and I'm a senior marine scientist. My guest today is Mikael Kamp-Sørensen, a specialist in physical geography and in marine energy and ports. In his role as a manager, he has been overseeing numerous marine EIAs. A very warm welcome to you, Mikael.
Frank, thank you very much for inviting me.
Mikael, we both have been involved in a variety of marine EIAs, and it's apparent that an environmental impact assessment and an EIA is very good for the developer to have some certainty about what they have to do in order to investigate the impacts of their plans on the environment. On the other hand, it's a very good system for the regulator to get some certainty on these impacts and actually to come to a plan approval decision. But really, yeah. Can you talk us through the process a little bit? Let's say we take the example of an offshore wind farm. How does an EIA work? What are the different components of an EIA?
So you can say if we start from the end, then you can say the ultimate goal is to get a permission to do your construction of the offshore wind farm. That is what you want to achieve. And in that process, you want to investigate possible impacts on the environment, including looking into possible mitigation measures for impacts. So that is where it all starts. And you will quickly find that across geographies, there will be many different types of regulations around this. We have a set of international regulations, some coming from the EU, some from other international organizations like OSPAR. And then the different countries also have their own guidelines. So sometimes it is a bit of a jungle to navigate the different regulatory setups that you have that will kind of define the boundaries for how you do your environmental impact assessment.
Sure. But there are also related components like in an EIA. So what is the first step?
Right. So typically, you will need some data to inform your environmental impact assessment. So one of the first steps is typically to go out and collect some baseline data. That could be data about seabirds, about marine mammals, about seabeds, about sediment, and many different things. And that will inform, you can say, also the scoping that you do. I mean, what are the factors that you need to investigate during the EIA process?
And for the EIA process, you use actually criteria to assess the impacts, let's say, on marine mammals. You use what we call noise exposure criteria to estimate actually the dimensions of the impact. And you kind of make some kind of formulation on, you know, what are the population level impacts? What part of the population is actually affected? And you come to some kind of risk assessment at the end. And only when you are actually finding that the impacts are profound and significant, you have to mitigate.
Yes, that's true. And there may be situations where you need to do things a little bit differently during the design or during the construction phase. And that may be, for instance, changing the design of the offshore wind farm to make seabird passage more feasible. It might also be during construction to use various types of mitigation measures to reduce underwater noise in the marine environment.
Right. For example, putting an air bubble curtain in. Exactly. But we will cover that in a very detailed podcast on underwater noise. Maybe let's talk a little bit about international regulations. Mm-hmm. Can you elaborate a little bit on what has been going on, let's say, in the past 10 years on this topic?
Sure. So you're right that we have different levels of regulation, international, as you say, moving on to national and in some countries even regional regulation informing this. You can say at the international level, we have certainly in Europe, we have the European Commission with various directives such as the Marine Strategy Framework Directive that informs about or sets guidelines for, you can say, for activities in the marine space, sets up certain indicators that needs to be complied with. You also have other types of EU directive, such as the Habitat Directive, the Birds Directive, that also need to be taken into consideration. And then you also have intergovernmental organizations like OSPAR also setting up guidelines and international regulation.
Yeah, I think the Marine Strategy Framework Directive is really important in this context because it defines, you know, descriptors for what the EU calls good environmental status. And at the moment, these kind of indicators are discussed in expert groups, for example, on underwater sound. What are actually indicators for good environmental status? Yes. Or bad environmental status in this case for underwater noise. So fascinating issues, really. What about standards, Michael? It's apparent that standards are really important to provide some kind of security for the developers and also the regulators. Can you enlighten us a little bit about standardization?
Yes, sure. So, I mean, what we want to avoid in these situations is, decisions based on expert judgment. We want to have standards that say, okay, these are some of the criteria that we need to look into. These are some of the data sets that we need to collect, and we need to do it in a certain way so that we can compare between different projects, so that we make sure that we follow a well-proven and scientific methodology. And so that it will be, you know, repeatable, that you will come out with the same result if you redo the analysis. I think that's very important for the whole credibility and the transparency of doing regulations, that we have some standards that both the industry and consultants need to comply with.
Yes, and certainly I have been involved, for example, in the German standards for environmental impact assessment. But they're very comprehensive, and very uniform. So basically, these standards are applied to every more or less to every project. And as I said, it's very beneficial to have them. But in other jurisdictions, you have more like on a case by case basis approach, where actually, for example, in the UK. Because the environmental conditions are also very different across the different sites. So it's actually, there's no one size fits all in this case, but you know, different countries have different philosophies, and this actually materializes in different standardizations. Really, really interesting. Michael, from your long-term practice, what are the most often encountered problems when it comes to an EIA, and what are actually the solutions to overcome these problems?
Very often, you're in the situation that you would like to have a lot of data that kind of describes the area that you're looking at. In many cases, you need to go out and collect that data, but that is time consuming and it's costly. So, I mean, ideally, if you can rely on existing data, that's a huge benefit. And there are techniques to take observations and scale them up and bring more value through the use of modeling techniques, so that if you have some point data sets that could be observations of birds or marine mammals or whatever, then combine that through modeling techniques to upscale the information to say something about a larger area. Because just like with weather forecasts, I mean, if you want more information, then you would rarely go out and put more thermometers in different locations. You would, I mean, it's a well-known technique within meteorology to use observations, and then you model, for instance, the temperature across a region. And we can actually use the same technique in the marine environment, using observations and then in increasing the value of those through modeling techniques to have, I mean, a more complete spatial output of whether it's mammal densities or bird densities and occurrence in a certain region.
Sure. And then this data, this modeling data can then be used, or these modeling results can then be used to inform actually the monitoring. So exactly. It's actually two sides of the same coin, which can improve each other when you do it really wisely. Exactly. That's fascinating. That's fascinating stuff, Michael. Well, let's have a look at the future at the end of this podcast. How do you see it? What is the future of of EIAs.
Right. I think coming back to the whole both societal and business challenge, we want to, as a society, to increase the expansion of offshore wind and support the green transition. And in order to do that, I think in the future that we need to be more efficient also when it comes to the environmental impact assessments. And I believe that we can go a long way by making sure the data is reusable. Again, that we use modeling techniques to scale up the spatial extent of observations. But also, I mean, with digitalization, it is actually possible to make the data available much more easily than today. Often, I mean, data sets today reside with individual authorities, universities, consultants. But I think in the future, we need to work much more together to make sure that the data is available to society and to the industry as a whole.
Yeah, so basically the answer is data, it's data portals, digitalization, and actually novel ways and actually providing this very important information for the developers, but also for the regulators to make informed decisions.
Exactly. And if I may add, I mean, I think when we are moving into the future, I think also the nature of environmental impact assessments will change. We've been used to a situation where you would get a yes or a no with your consenting application based on your EIA. I think in the future, we will see more conditional approvals saying that, yes, you will get the permit to operate your wind farm, but you have to be able to shut down under certain circumstances. That could be if you have high densities of birds moving towards the wind farm. Mm-hmm. And I think that's something that we will see more of in the future. And that's something that has to be managed. But luckily, there's also technology available to solve that problem.
Yes, like novel ways of, you know, registering birds in an offshore wind farm through, you know, a combination of smart technologies.
Exactly, because it's something that can be that can actually be monitored fairly automatically today. So there is a way out, and that's actually an option for having offshore wind farms in areas where previously you would have maybe said no. But in the future, we may be able to say yes on the condition that certain operational criteria are met.
Well, that was really fascinating. I think we have made a really interesting walk through the EIAs and regulations concerning offshore wind. We are reaching the end of our episode. Thank you very much, Michael, for the very valuable information.
Mike, thank you for having me. It was a pleasure.
And I thank everyone out there for tuning in.
Thanks for listening to Water Insider. You can find more episodes on our website, dhigroup.com, or anywhere you get your podcasts. And don't forget to follow us.